We're talking about helping kids feel seen and valued. It is a conversation about parenting here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So let's establish the fact that we are imperfect humans, right? There are those moments when I want do-overs with my kids, when I wasn't there for them, or I judged them without fully realizing what I was doing. It's a bad feeling all around, and it happens. Do the demands of life affect your ability to be present and engaged with your child? Is it your job? Is it household chores, keeping up with a calendar of commitments? What's the hardest thing about helping your child thrive? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Daniel Siegel is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine, and he's co-authored a new book. It's called The Power of Showing Up: How Parental Presence Shapes Who Our Kids Become and How Their Brains Get Wired. Dr. Siegel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So the concept of showing up here, it's not just about getting to the bus on time and meeting your child there. It's not just about making sure you show up tomorrow at that school concert. What does showing up really mean?
Well, showing up really means that there's an inner life of your child, what we can simply call their mind, that he or she is having feelings, having thoughts, having memories. And when you actually learn to focus your attention as a parent on those, your parenting actually becomes more effective and even more fun, and your child will develop in a way that they can thrive. So we can talk about the details of what showing up means, but at its root, it's about sensing the inner life of your child, keeping them safe, having them be seen, all these things that go on top of what you mentioned, you know, taking care of their activities and behaviors. This is going beneath their behaviors to the mind that's driving those behaviors.
How do I really know what's going on in that inner world of my child, that inner life and inside their brain?
Okay, that is a great question. So any parent listening to us right now can just pause for a moment and think, how do you know even how you yourself are having a feeling, which I know sounds maybe silly? You go, well, I feel it. And the wonderful news is when you feel your inner life, your emotions, what your body is telling you, like a heartfelt sense or a feeling in your gut, that's the beginning of how we know actually how someone else is feeling. Because we have like essentially an antenna that's called our body that picks up the signals. And it sounds mysterious, but it's actually not. It's like the tone of voice. Like if I say like this, you said, welcome, Dan. And I go, good morning, Kate. Or I said, good morning, Kate. That's the words are the same, but you're picking up right the tone. So that's one of several signals we get. You know, if we're seeing someone with our eyes, we can see what they're doing in terms of their gestures or their posture, their facial expression, their eye contact. There are many ways where we develop what I call mindsight. We sense the mind of oneself for insight, for another person like our child, for empathy. And from that comes understanding what's going on with them.
There's lots of cues that we're picking up on, such subtle things going on in their life. And what happens when we do pick up on these cues and we follow through and ask questions to the child?
Exactly. Well, then you find out what's going on and why it's going on. And, you know, what I find really helpful, you know, I'm trained to study in terms of research how parents interacting with children impacts how those children develop throughout their childhood into their adolescence. And now in the field I work in, attachment research, we have studies going where the babies who weren't even born when the study began are now in their 40s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I just wrote a summary with Alan Stroh, who was the lead researcher in that study. And in that summary, we had the fun of saying, wow, look what 40 years of careful study from attachment interactions, like we're talking about, the way you communicate with your child is what your relationship is based on, how it impacts how your child will do when they're in their 40s. We now know that.
We're talking about parenting this hour with Dr. Daniel Siegel. He's a UCLA clinical psychiatrist, co-author of the new book, The Power of Showing Up. You can join in. Are you concerned about your child's ability to forge healthy relationships or confidently handle new experiences, new situations? How do you coach them? How do you show up for them? Do you have any examples of where this went well, or perhaps a situation that's been really stumping you, weighing on you? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Siegel, we're going to get into your four S's, the safe and the seen, the soothe and the secure. But I first wanted to ask you about a little passage in the beginning of your book. It's Christopher Robin to Winnie the Pooh. And my eyes lit up when I saw it because the quote is on my daughter's billboard. And she received the quote, not from me, but from her daycare provider when she was 2 years old. And this little scrap of paper has been following her. And the quote is, "You are braver than you believe, stronger than you seem, and smarter than you think. But the most important thing is, even if we're apart, I'll always be with you." What is it about those words that cause you pause?
Well, you bring tears to my eyes, Kate. You know, it's, I'm so happy your daughter finds those words also really meaningful. And we put it at the front of the book because, you know, attachment is really all about everything that that says. It's really believing in the most in your child, and not to pressure them, but just to empower them. And the end of that quote about, you know, even when we're apart, you know, we'll always be together. That's actually what secure attachment is. It's these S's that we'll talk about basically allow your child's inner experience, and we can talk in part about how the mind is related to the brain and the head, but you even have brains in your intestines and brains in your heart, believe it or not. So it's this overall bodily experience where you feel literally the loving presence of your parent, so that as you go out as an adolescent and you go out as an adult and into your 40s, we now know, you carry that loving parent with you because they showed up for you. And when you tease it apart and say, okay, well, how do I do that? How do I do that? I know my kids are now 25. I was just with my daughter here in New York where I'm visiting, and my son is 30. And, you know, you can sense, because my wife and I really put energy and intention into showing up, and the research shows that when you do that, your child will have this inner sense of calm and clarity, this sense that, you know, if I need to, I can face things that are difficult and do my best, and that'll be fine. And I can have relationships with people that are mutually rewarding and really be satisfying in my life. And, you know, so when you see that, it even continues in your connection with them, certainly when you're with them, but then when they're apart, they feel that fullness, they feel that being at ease and that sense of resilience.
And when they have that safety, I think what you're getting at is that it allows the brain to do a whole host of other things, that safety is taken care of, and therefore they can explore their world.
Yeah, so safety is the first and important thing you're mentioning about what attachment really does. And, you know, we've had it for a long time, 200 million years, really, as mammals. And what attachment fundamentally is can we keep our youth, our young, our babies safe? And for us humans, safety has two parts to it. One is, you know, are we protecting them from harm? You know, so we're taking care of them when they're really little. Then once they're toddlers running around, we protect them from getting into trouble. But the other safety we can talk about is about making sure we're not terrifying our kids. And when we do, we make a repair, because we can flub up, do things that are scary. But if we can make a repair, then we can reconnect and teach our child that even if things get tough, they'll get better.
We're talking with psychiatrist and author Daniel Siegel. The new book is The Power of Showing Up. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about how to be emotionally and mentally present with our kids. It's a parenting conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So more and more we live in this culture where we feel the pressure to be available as soon as we hear that ding of a cell phone notification, or our mind goes elsewhere from what is directly in front of us. And then what's actually in front of us is those little eyes that are looking upward and perhaps wondering what's so pressing to take our minds away from the now. Do you think about your screen time and how it affects your relationship with your child? How did your own upbringing influence how you raise your child today? Bring your examples, your tricky situations, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. UCLA psychiatrist Daniel Siegel stays with us. His new book is called The Power of Showing Up. Let's take a call now. Boots is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Boots.
Hey, good morning. This sounds like a really great book, and I'm really interested in reading it. Wondering, trying to put this in a soundbite, I have come to realize that this delusion of independence that we teach our children is really deleterious, that when they grow up really believing they're independent, the health and well-being of others really isn't important, and that a teaching of interdependence is much more valuable. And not only is showing up important, but the language that we use with our kids is really important. And I'm wondering if you've heard of conscious discipline or restorative practice, that those are two methods that talk about not just showing up, being present, but the language that we use and how important that is.
Boots, thanks for bringing that into the conversation. Dr. Siegel, what do you see there?
I think this question is one of the most important questions, not only for our children, but for the planet. And in a textbook I write for college and graduate school called The Developing Mind, you know, which all the science for the power of showing up comes from, and all the books I write on parenting come from, what is said is exactly what you're saying about interdependence, that we've made an error aiming for independence, and you can simply call it like the separate self that's going to go it alone and take care of itself by itself, all by its lonesome, and you know, that's the goal of development. And some people raise their kids that way with a separate self view. This solo, shrunken, really separate self can be emphasized by parenting, by schooling, even by society. And the way in this field I work in interpersonal neurobiology from a science point of view, bringing all the sciences together, interdependence and acknowledging the reality of our interconnection starts at home. So in The Whole Brain Child, all the way through The Power of Showing Up, Tina Payne Bryce and my co-author and I write exactly about what you're talking about the way we raise a kid is not just as a me, and not losing the importance of knowing their inner life as a me, but also being a we. So we have a fun term that I use in my different teachings called MWE, M-W-E, me plus we, allows both to be important, and that's where the interdependence comes from, as MWE. And the beautiful thing is, when you look at studies of, how happy people are, or even their mental health, or their medical health, or how long they live even, it comes down to being a part of a social network in which you belong. And you learn this at home, that you become someone who is of service to the well-being of others. And now we know it's not just other people, but it's all living beings through all of nature. And I think if we raise kids that way, and if we as adults remember that that's actually the more honest way to live, it's going to be a better world. So any kind of approach that supports the recognition of the reality of interconnection, I think is what we need to support in going forward as a human family. Absolutely. It's a beautiful, beautiful notion you're raising. And thank you, Boots. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. We are discussing the importance of parents being there for their kids. Our guide is Dr. Daniel Siegel. He's a UCLA clinical psychiatrist, and the new book is called The Power of Showing Up. You can join in the conversation. How much have you reflected on the way your own childhood influenced your own development and how things are today with your child? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at at WPR.org. Well, Dr. Siegel, let's get on with these S's here. Another S is feeling seen, that the child really feels a connection and feels like they matter. What is it about being seen?
You know, seen exactly like you're describing it, Kate, is basically where your inner life, what you're thinking, what you're feeling, your memories, your perception, your point of view, it may not be understood exactly right by your parent, but when they are interested in knowing it, we call that being tuned in or attuned, you know, you get a feeling that you can simply say is called feeling felt. One of my patients once told me that term, and I said, wow, that's so specific and so beautiful. A child feels felt when you're interested in knowing it. So you asked earlier, how do we really know what's going on inside of another person, like our child? So here's the way to think about it. If you focus your attention as a parent on asking, what's going on right now in my child, not just what their physical behavior is, like if they're, you know, throwing a pillow at their younger sibling and you're really angry at them, you can ask, why did they throw the pillow? What are they feeling? What was going on? You may not want to let them throw the pillow. It's just a pillow, but you want to stop them from hurting anyone, of course. So safety is our number one. But when we come to seeing, you then sit down, get at your child's level, and say, what was going on that you threw that pillow? Now, your child may be too young to articulate it, so you may have to take a guess. And the guesses should be like questions. So if your child's really young, you go, I wonder if you were feeling mad that your little baby brother, you know, was getting my attention and you were feeling kind of lonely. Now, you don't know that for sure, but when you make it in the phrase, I wonder, or could it be, you're showing that you're not being some kind of what people call omniscient, like know it all, think I know what you're feeling and you don't. Instead, you say, I'm interested in what you're feeling. I'm interested in knowing why you threw the pillow, and I want to tune in to your inner life. And I may not get it right the first time, but together in our communication, you may shake your head, go, no, I wasn't frightened. I was really upset with what Aunt Sally did or something like that. And then I find out more. So it becomes an inquiry with questions, not a proclamation, I know what you're feeling. It's, I'm interested in what you're feeling. I wonder if it could be this. Oh, it's not that. Could it be that? Or what do you think it is? And then you find out on a journey of communication what's going on. And that's really, really important. It develops what's called mindsight, seeing the mind. And it builds on what the prior person asking the question, Boots, it builds on what he said, because it teaches your child that we're all connected to each other, that our feelings we have inside relate to what happens with other people. And we learn the importance of what's called emotional and social intelligence. And this is where we begin to learn it, by teaching that the inner nature of our lives being seen is very important to share.
Well, and on that inquiry journey of exploring with that young child, you know, that situation, what might happen in their mind, you're also at the same time on that journey able to soothe them, because they're comforted with you that you're actually exploring and paying attention and noticing them.
Exactly. Well, this third S, so we have safety is number one, being seen is number two, where a child feels felt. And number three is being soothed, knowing that if we don't get these right the first time, you can always try again. And also, if we flub up and miss the opportunity, we can go back and what's called make a repair or make a reconnection when there's a disconnection. So there's no such thing as perfect parenting. If you're listening to this, Kate and I are not trying to say, hey, there's a perfect way to do it. But there is a direction, even though there's no perfection. And by learning these three S's, keeping your child safe, having them be seen, and then soothe is exactly like you're saying it. When we are keeping them safe and they're being seen, when we tune into them, especially when they're in a state of discomfort, when they're in distress, some people call it suffering, you know, when there's this negative feeling, some parents get very uncomfortable and they want to just distract their child, or they want to just avoid it and not pay attention to that because it's too upsetting for them. So presence, parental presence is what we're talking about, is opening up this capacity for you as a parent to learn really the art, and it's a learnable art, of being with your child even when they feel distressed, and maybe even especially when they feel distressed, so that you don't try to take them away from it immediately. You try to say, I see you're really sad, or I sense that you're really angry, or, oh, that must have been so frightening when you fell off your tricycle. Not just, oh, it's okay, get up. What that teaches your child is you can't even tolerate their distress, but when you are staying with them in it, it's soothing because they realize, wow, I was really scared or sad or angry. My parent is with me. My anger or sadness or other forms of distress, they're now decreasing in their intensity because I'm with my parent who understands
me. We're together in the moment. Yeah.
We're together in the moment, and that's the key to soothing.
Dr. Daniel Siegel telling us about the things children need to feel safe with their parents, breaking down the S's, safe, seen, soothed, secure. Does your young person crave attention? How does that affect your relationship with them? Do you fear this will create issues in the future? Do you find it's difficult to assure your child that things will be okay when you're not sure they will? How do you approach that? Join in 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll pick this up with Dr. Siegel after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Be sure to join us after 8 for analysis on Super Tuesday results. We'll have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert for the hour. He'll be weighing in on that big day of the 2020 election cycle. He'll have that rundown on what the results mean, and we'll make time for your reaction through the hour. That is after 8. Right now, we're discussing what parents and caregivers can do to help children grow into successful and content and secure adults. And dare I ask this question, what makes a good parent? There's no one right answer, but join in on ways you get kids to show you who they are. How do you create space for the young people in your life? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. Dr. Daniel Siegel is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine. His new book is called The Power of Showing Up, and he stays with us. Dr. Siegel, Susan from Milwaukee called in, couldn't stay with us, and Susan is a retired teacher and says that they know that connecting and being a solid place for kids sometimes happens with people other than their parents. And Susan says it's essential that we have that profound ability to connect with people other than our own children. What do you make of Susan's point?
You know, Susan's point, and it's so important to raise this, is scientifically 100% accurate. We have something very unusual as a human species, and that has the formal name. It's called alloparenting, and what allo means is other, and parenting, of course, is those who care for children. So alloparenting means that we as a species, we give our children, our babies, to other parents than the birth parents. You know, not the mother, not the father. We give it to someone else in our community that we need to trust. Now, alloparenting means that the baby, the human baby, is born with the ability to attach to, yes, the mother and the father for sure, but then to a selective few others in their early life. And so attachment research, you know, the science of attachment, not like some parenting approaches that use that word attachment that say it's only the mother, that's actually wrong. For humanity, we have more than one attachment figure. That's what the science of attachment shows. And so when we get older, like when we're in school, and Susan's a former teacher, you know, as a retired teacher, you know, Susan, that what we do is we extend attachment then to our teachers. When we get into adolescence, we even have attachment to close friends. When we become adults, we have romantic partners that are our attachment figures. We even have mentors who can be attachment figures. And throughout our life, having a special relationship with someone with whom we feel safe, we need to be seen, we can be soothed, and then develop the fourth S of being secure, which is this overall model, we can use that, what we learned hopefully in our childhood, that we're interdependent beings and that we can have these important relationships. Some of them will be attachment relationships, where with our close friends, they can be our attachment figures and we can be theirs too.
Well, sometimes these attachment behaviors can be tricky and challenging, maybe even backfire a bit. Can you guide us through some ambivalent attachment or disorganized attachment, avoidant? What do those mean?
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, those are terms that relate to when we study parent-child relationships. We find they fall into what are called patterns. So for some kids, fortunately, it's a little over half, they have secure attachment. And what that means is that they were safe, they were seen, they were soothed on a reliable basis. When ruptures to those things happened, they were repaired. And so the child could learn to depend on the parent for those three S's. Then they develop the fourth S of being secure. And then when we study them in, you know, schools and camps, and then as adolescents and adults into their 40s, we see they have these qualities where they can regulate their emotions, they can have mutually rewarding relationships with other people, and they even have a sense of belonging to a larger whole than just their separate self. So that's a fascinating thing about security. Now, around a third to a little under a half, depending on the study, of kids with their primary caregiver have a non-secure, or what the scientists call insecure, form of attachment. It's important to realize that even though you may hear the word insecure, it doesn't mean the same as how we use that term in general language, like, oh, that's an insecure person. No, it just means that, for example, with avoidance, you mentioned that is about a fifth of the population in the United States. So one out of five kids with their primary caregiver, this kind of relationship where the child may be safe, but they're not really seen and they're not really soothed because the parent is not focusing on the inner experience of the child, their feelings, their memories, their perceptions, all that stuff. And so their behavior is being managed for safety. They're being taken to their games and, you know, their schedule is set up. The parents love their kids, for sure, but they themselves often didn't have someone teach them how to go inward to really see someone, and then it's hard to soothe them. So that child develops what's called an avoidant attachment. And, you know, when we study those parent-child relationships, that child with their primary caregiver who's avoidantly attached will go on and be somewhat emotionally controlling of others. They'll be emotionally distant from knowing their own life. They have trouble with insight. They have a lot of trouble with tuning into the inner world of others. And when they get to be adults, there's a tendency, of course, everybody can change depending on their life circumstances, but there's a tendency for them to have what's called a dismissing state where they say, hey, relationships are not important. I'm a solo operator in the world. Here are my needs. Let me get my needs met. And that's called avoidant attachment.
We're talking about parenting with Dr. Daniel Siegel, clinical psychiatrist at UCLA. The new book is called The Power of Showing Up, and your thoughts, your situations are welcome. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Siegel, you also look at hyperparenting. A lot of what we're talking about here is really being connected with that child, being a part of their life. Parents also are concerned about being over-involved. Where do you see a line?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And, you know, my in-laws are from Wisconsin. And I have a very fond feeling about that. And, you know, when I was a researcher in attachment, their big concern was that, you know, my tuning in these S's ways, you know, was going to spoil their first grandchild. And we had some really fun discussions about it because, you know, I love them, they love me, and they were trying to guide my parenting to letting my child just cry, to, you know, they had a certain, you know, philosophy about it. And it was really fascinating because they were doing it out of love because they wanted the outcome to be where their child was strong and independent. And they do have wonderfully strong, independent kids, the four of them. And however, the research, I told them, suggests that, you know, when we actually keep our child safe, which they were certainly supporting, but when we see them, which is what they thought I was overdoing, and when we soothe them, which they thought I was overdoing, it actually builds the circuits in the child's brain to see themselves and see others, and then to actually be able to soothe themselves. So they're actually, instead of just being independent and I do it on my own, they're actually more tuned in. So That's a little, that's the other extreme away from hyperparenting. With hyperparenting, that term is used to mean someone's over-involved, either, you know, excessively, you know, scheduling their kid, you know, because they want their kid to get in the best, you know, high school and the best college and the best whatever graveyard or whatever that, you know, frenetic view, at least in California, is, you know, where people hyperparent that way. Or there's another kind of hyperparenting where you read so many parenting books that you don't know what to do because they're conflictual, you know, and so you say, oh my God, I better just make sure I never let my baby off my chest, or, you know, I'm always with my baby. And, you know, the studies show that that actually is not very good for your child. There's a balance when we look at attachment research between being a safe haven where your child can be safe and seen and soothed, but then you're a secure launching pad. That's the security part, where you support their going out and exploring the world. And sometimes they have to do that with downtime where you're not scheduling all their hours of the day. That means that when they fall down and they've hurt their knee, you don't fall down and start crying about it or suddenly, you know, whisk them up. You go down and you check in with them to see how they're doing, and they can see that you are somewhat different than they are and that you, the reaction to the falling down and hurting their knee. And in that space with your presence, you actually create the opposite of hyperparenting. You create, you know, attuned present parenting. And as you do this, you know, what's beautiful about it is you have a whole bunch of science behind you to show that, unlike doing the totally independent, you know, let your kid do it on their own, or the hyperparenting, there's this middle way.
But
that really supports healthy resilience developing your child.
And it seems logical and it's really elegant, but sometimes parents just need a break from parenting. When we take time for ourselves, what's going on there? What does research tell us when we check out for a little bit?
Well, it depends on how old the kid is. And I say this because, you know, because of alloparenting. So, you know, some parents are told you never have anyone but the birth parents take care of the children. And that is scientifically inaccurate in terms of what we do as a human species. And so when you're told that, it's putting unscientific suggestions on you that are actually unfair to you. So for a little baby, of course, you know, you would need another caregiver there so you can go out for a walk, you can go work out at the gym, you can take time to read, that we do raise children in community. And having trusted other adults around or very much older, you know, adolescents who are responsible, you know, can take care of that child. So for really a young child, they really can't be just left on their own. But some parents say, oh, I'm going to just leave this baby on their own. Well, that's actually not okay to do that for a baby.
We have to pause right there with clinical psychiatrist and author Daniel Siegel, who stays with us. His new book is The Power of Showing Up. Are you concerned about your child's ability to forge healthy relationships, your ability to bond with your child? Do you have examples of where this went well or this didn't work out? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment. There's more conversation here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're getting at the heart of what kids really need from their parents when we have a conversation with our kids, when we play with them, take a walk with them, when we tune into their experiences in this really hectic world. And these moments, they add up in a big way as we're learning. You can join in with your parenting moments and your challenges. 800-642-1234. Did the demands of life affect your ability to be present and engaged with your child? What is it that is holding you back? Still time for you. Can call in, email ideas at WPR.org, and UCLA psychiatrist Daniel Siegel, co-author of the new book called The Power of Showing Up. Dr. Siegel, it seems more than ever that, you know, we've got our hands on our digital devices at all times. How much of that screen time and our need to check whatever is happening on our phones, can that affect the relationship with a child?
Kate, this is one of the most pressing and important questions that we're facing today as parents, because these devices do distract us. So at the very minimum, they can keep us actually from monitoring what's physically going on and keeping our child safe. I have seen parents walk across the street to our local school on their phone, pushing a stroller and almost getting hit by a car because they were walking in the street doing that. So safety is threatened. Being seen, you know, this is why the S's are so useful to address this question. If you're on your screen, you cannot literally tune in to the signals your child is sending because you're distracted on your phone, your computer, whatever. So you can't, you know, see them, you know, emotionally, their inner life. And soothing, I've seen parents, and this is the strangest thing, at a meal where everyone's on their device, someone's really upset, the kid can be trying to make a, you know, she's trying to connect to her mom or dad, but they're busy on their phone. We get so focused on these screens, and as you're saying, there's this feeling like, oh my God, I have to be connected to whoever's communicating with me. And there's some studies to show, even if you put a phone on, let's say, a dinner table, the depth of conversation is much more superficial than if that object weren't on there. Those phones, those devices, basically take us out of relationship with our children or even our friends and other family members. So to start with the most basic thing, presence means showing up for, let's say we're talking about parenting here, but it's the same thing with your romantic relationship or the same thing with friendships. You know, when we're with our kids, our children are learning from us that we are literally taking our eyes and looking at them. We're listening to them with our ears. We're feeling them with our heart and our gut. We're just getting a sense of our whole bodily connection with them.
And we only have about a minute left, but I love asking people like you, where do you find optimism right now? Where do you find hope in your research?
I find hope because the research is clear. You can change how you've been doing it. If you listen to what Kate and I are saying and go, God, I haven't been doing it that way, but can I change? The answer is absolutely yes. By just learning this strategy, these four S's, you actually can learn to be safe inside yourself, to see yourself, to soothe yourself, and to develop security. That's what the incredibly optimistic research-based finding is. It's never too late, ever, to take this information in, do the inner work that you need, and then show up for yourself as well as being able to show up for your kids.
And you'll continue this research even though your research subjects are in their 40s.
That's right. The attachment research world is filled with continuing studies. And the great news is we're not talking about fixed ways of being. We're talking about ways we can always grow across the lifespan and keep on learning.
Well, Dr. Siegel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Daniel Siegel is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine, co-authored the new book, The Power of Showing Up, that examines how child development is influenced by parents being present in their kids' lives. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum asking the question, what was Milwaukee's first hip-hop song?
Our friends at 88.9 Radio Milwaukee put out a podcast last year called Backspin, the search for Milwaukee's first hip-hop song.
Are you ready?
Hosts Tyrone Miller.
I'm just really curious about just hip-hop in general. Love the culture, been a part of it my whole life.
And Justin Barney.
My interest in this is academic. I want to know what the first hip-hop song is. I want to answer that question.
They take listeners on a musical and historical journey as they talk with pioneering Milwaukee DJs and reminisce about dance clubs and house parties of the past. While listening to Backspin, you quickly learn that what is Milwaukee's first hip-hop song is a really complicated question. Milwaukee's first hip-hop record could be this song, Class A. It was released in 1981 by the Majestics.
We are down, and for real, we all have a lot of sex appeal, so hey... By the way, the women said we are Class A.
The Majestics were a funk and R&B group that put out a disco rap song.
Do y'all consider yourselves rappers, or did y'all just make a rap song?
We just made a rap song.
Gotcha.
We ain't no five, we rappers. When dream of it. Because you don't call anybody can rap.
Yeah.
Because you rapping now, just put the music behind.
Right.
See?
After Class A came out, it didn't have a huge impact. It didn't inspire a new wave of rappers. But then this song came along in 1985.
Our music is formatic, it's implied without static. But I'm not only deed, if that's emphatic. My rhymes give a something I kind over nine, put appropriate in battle. Whatever.
We were definitely the first like official hip hop crew to release a record of hip hop in Milwaukee, and that was the song called Attack on the Wax.
That's Todd Thomas, aka Peachy, aka Speech.
Excuse me, Peachy. May I?
May you what?
May I get on the turntables?
Why, of course.
And we felt it was cool, but we felt, at least me, I felt we could do better. So we went back in the studio and did a better version of that song and included three other songs on that EP, I should say.
PG on the steel, and you know he's chill. Two techniques under his hand, because that's the real deal. Fresh beats are delivered to the north and south and at.
He didn't give a damn, he keeps rocking the house.
Yeah, that was the first hip-hop record that I remember, though, from a hip-hop crew.
Miller and Barney found the majority of the music community credits Speech with jumpstarting the city's hip-hop scene.
Every single person that we've talked to, from the MCs, the DJs, producers, every single person mentioned Speech. Is that correct?
Literally every single one.
And it was not just, okay, I rapped with him. He produced a song for him. He influenced them by just being such a great guy in the community. Or they knew him, they worked with him, they met with him. They just knew where he lived. He was just around.
And everyone had such reverence
right.
for Speech.
One of the things that I think people wouldn't realize is that we never traveled to New York. We didn't know anybody that ever written or did a rap record. So for us, it was a lot of guessing. And unlike today, there was no internet. You couldn't go to YouTube and check out how somebody did something. And we were trying to do the best we could to make an authentic hip-hop record. You know, like, I didn't want to be just a quote-unquote Milwaukee artist. You know what I mean? Like, I knew that Milwaukee had to rise to the occasion of New York because New York was defining hip-hop. And, you know, I wanted Milwaukee to have that same legitimate sound. And I feel like we accomplished it with that EP.
Soon after, Speech left Milwaukee to go to school in Atlanta, where he formed the Grammy Award-winning group Arrested Development. The rest is music history. Check out Radio Milwaukee's podcast, Backspin, and decide for yourself. Was the city's first hip-hop song Class A or Attack on the Wax? Does it even matter what came first? Take a deeper dive into this story through the podcast, Backspin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And be sure to join us after 8 for analysis on Super Tuesday results. We have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief, Craig Gilbert, for the hour. We'll get up to speed on results, your reactions throughout the hour. That's after 8. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.